endless men whose age will be not to defend some ancient creed, but to live out the laws of Christ in every thought and word and deed. God send us men alert and quick, His lofty precepts to translate, until the laws of Christ become the laws and habits of the state.
Welcome to God Send Us Men Ministries with evangelist and missionary to America, Charlie Stewart. We challenge you to open your Bible and follow along with today's message. Prove all things, hold fast that which is good, study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. To contact us or read and listen to more teachings online for free, visit GodSendUsMen.com. And now, here is evangelist and missionary to America, Charlie Stewart.
Gentle shepherd. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for tuning into the message this morning. Please remember the prayer requests that are on the prayer request page on the website. And I know that everyone listed that is listed there with their specific need greatly appreciates the prayers. Before we get into today's message, I want to share a few things that I found interesting this week. Well, the first thing was a photograph that my daughter sent me as she and her husband were traveling home last weekend after a visit here. Well, Christopher had spotted a quote, license plate on a car that was passing them, and my daughter quickly snapped the photo. And the tag wasn't a state-issued tag, but rather it said something to the effect of private, not for hire. I've never seen one of these myself in real life, but I've seen videos of people that put those on their cars. It's not for me, but I completely understand what they're doing and why they do it. Many times, the people that are doing this are labeled with the dreaded sovereign citizen label, and that's a term I also understand, but I certainly refuse that too. Although I understand the real meaning of the term, even in their world, with their constitution and their Declaration of Independence, I tread very carefully with the use of the word sovereign, because I know that there's only one that is sovereign, and it's not man, and it's definitely not me. The God of heaven and his Son are the only sovereigns in the world and in the heavens. Now, while he's made all of his sons kings and princes in the earth, we got to be very careful not to take on titles that ultimately belong exclusively to him, if for nothing else, for fear of sending the wrong message. Man is not sovereign. God is sovereign. And when man stays under the sovereignty of God, well, he definitely receives certain special privileges and franchises, but he must hold them subject to the laws of God and the limitations defined in the Holy Scriptures. The power that God has given him is limited by the laws of God, and he can make no contract not authorized by the Scriptures, and his rights to live life are only preserved to him so long as he obeys the laws of the Creator. So in that sense, a born-again child of the living God does have limited, quote, sovereignty in that he owes nothing to any man beyond that which the Scriptures declare, which is that he shall not commit adultery, shall not kill, commit murder, shall not steal, shall not bear false witness, shall not covet, and if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. Now, I've said many times before that for the most part, I'm happy to see resistance to tyranny, such as what we see with those, quote, tags. But I would much rather see men living in obedience to the laws of God as their reasoning for resistance to the, quote, law, statutes, ordinances, rules, regulations, that mere men have sat around some table somewhere deciding that they will enforce on other men, even on those who openly declare that their sole allegiance is to the God of heaven and his laws. Well, what is the origin of the not-for-hire private vehicle tag that my daughter's family saw? Well, if you just go on the internet and just type in legal definition of driver, you know, disregard the response that comes back from AI. That's a bunch of propaganda. But go down to the Legal Information Institute. Now, this is a, quote, legal website that provides actual citations from their U.S. code. And this is what you find, and it tells you exactly where it's found in their millions and millions and millions of laws, rules, regulations, statutes, ordinances, cons, etc. Quote, the term driver means a person that drives a commercial vehicle in cross-border long-haul trucking services, end quote. Go down a little further to 29 CFR at 782.3, drivers, Legal Information Institute. Quote, an individual who drives a motor vehicle in transportation, which is within the meaning of the Motor Carrier Act, in interstate or foreign commerce, end quote. So the, quote, sovereign citizen, or the rebellious U.S. citizen, the one who thinks the Constitution made him a free man, okay, through these definitions and through the citations of their own court cases, has determined that as long as he declares himself to be non-commercial, then he is free from the millions of, quote, laws, rules, regulations, statutes, ordinances, cons, well, not that, for traveling, which extorts billions and billions of dollars from people every year just for the reason of moving yourself from one place to the next. All of it is a giant extortion racket that is designed to take one man's property, the labor of his hire, and give it to someone else, namely the, quote, government, so the, quote, government can disperse a man's wages to someone else or for something else. While I'm happy to see people traveling down the roads without state, quote, tags, which are just receipts for paying their extortion fees, I wish we could reach those people with the truth that freedom is available by coming to Christ, by rejecting the world and the world's millions and millions of laws, statutes, rules, regulations, ordinances, cons, and simply giving their life to obedience to the tiny little few, minute handful of laws that God has said His creation is to live by. It is true Christians, true believers that God has granted this wonderful freedom to. And I so wish there were more true Christians who would live according to the freedom that Christ gives. Well, Jeff has seen similar tags like the one Taylor and Chris saw. Jerry has seen them. But I wish I could see one, because I'd try to stop the individual if I could and try to talk to them about the government of God. I know that in my own life, when I was trying to figure these things out years ago, as barely 20 years old, when I finally realized the reality that God has a government, and it's the government that all men are required to be citizens of, and when I embraced that understanding and realized that everything that men were saying was rebellion, as in rebellion to the little g, quote, governments of men, that it actually wasn't rebellion, but rather obedience to the government of God. And it's the government that all men are required to be citizens of. And when I embraced that understanding and realized that everything that men were saying was rebellion, that it wasn't rebellion, but rather it was obedience to the government of God. And that was the greatest amount of relief I've ever experienced in my lifetime. I'm not rebellious. How can I rebel against something that I'm not even a party to? Okay, in order to rebel against something, all right, I looked up the definition of the word rebellion, and I liked what I saw from Wikipedia. That link is in the notes. Quote, rebellion is an uprising that resists and is organized against one's government. Quote unquote. Okay, right from the end of quote, I mean, right from the beginning. That's not me. When have I ever said a single thing negative about the government of God, let alone resisted it? My government is the government of God, the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of Christ. I've declared it publicly for my entire life. I've declared it in the courts of the world. I've declared it in the jails of the world. I've declared it to the jailers. I've declared it to the cops. I've declared it to their persecutors, their lawyers, their judges. I've written it in my books. I've stated it orally in hundreds of messages over the last 40 years. I don't pay taxes to earthly, quote, governments. I don't have their ID tags. How can I possibly be accused of rebellion against man's, quote, government when I've publicly declared and have backed it up by living that I've got no connection to them? You can't rebel against something, a, quote, government that isn't yours. Their very first statement in their definition, rebellion is an uprising that resists and is organized against one's government. Okay, well, my government is not any little g, quote, government of the world. It goes on. A rebel is a person who engages in a rebellion. A rebel group is a consciously coordinated group that seeks to gain political control over an entire state or a portion of a state. A rebellion is often caused by political, religious, or social grievances that originate from a perceived inequality or marginalization. Rebellion comes from Latin re and bellum, and in Lockean philosophy refers to the responsibility of the people to overthrow unjust government. End quote. Well, some of that sounds okay. I don't agree with any of it when you boil it down. But this is talking about an organized effort to overthrow man's government. It says, gain political control over the state. Well, the state it's not a piece of land. The state is the collection of laws that a certain geographic area of people create for themselves and then agree to abide by. The state is not something that's physical. It's an imaginary creation of men, which with people agree to align themselves with. State is a condition, a state of being. My job is not to overthrow the state, a state, any state. Okay, that's not my responsibility. My job, my responsibility is to leave any association with anything that is not following God's exclusive government. My job, my responsibility is personal obedience. I must obey God whether anyone else in the world chooses to or not. Okay, if there's any hope for changing the world, that change must first begin in my own life. Obedience to the commands of the Scripture to come out from among them and be separate. That is not rebellion to man. It is obedience to God. And if they take that as rebellion, that's their problem. They need to take it up with God. I'm not hurting anyone. I'm not robbing anyone. I'm obeying what I believe the Bible teaches and trying as hard as I can to follow the example shown by Christ and by his disciples and of all the saints who showed examples in their lives of what it means to follow God, to follow Christ, to follow the Bible. And if the world doesn't get it, well, then the world doesn't get it. Well, I get it. I understand it. And I have the, quote, right to my understandings and beliefs, well, actually more than others who think their, quote, rights come from a con. My responsibilities, my commands come from the God of creation. And I happen to believe it's 1,000 times better to yield to the God of creation than to yield to the gods of the world. It goes on, classification. See also list of revolutions and rebellions. Let me see if there's any reason to read any of that. It's in the notes. An insurrection is an uprising to change the government. If a government does not recognize rebels as belligerents, then they are insurgents and the revolt is an insurgency. In a larger conflict, the rebels may be recognized as belligerents without their government being recognized by the established government, in which case the conflict becomes a civil war, end quote. I'm not now, nor have I ever, tried to, quote, change the government. They say that in order to, quote, change the government, you should vote. Well, I've preached for my entire life that true Christians, true followers of Christ, do not vote. The gospel is not about an uprising to, quote, change the government. It is a call for men and women, boys and girls to come out from the little g, quote, governments of men and into the government of God. Now, if enough people become believers and men's little g, quote, governments fall, then great. Then the world would certainly be a better place, no question about that. Okay, it goes on. Civil resistance movements have often aimed at and brought about the fall of a government or head of state, and in these cases, they could be considered a form of rebellion. In many of these cases, the opposition movement saw itself not only as nonviolent, but also as upholding their country's constitutional system against a government that was unlawful. For example, if it had refused to acknowledge its defeat in an election. Thus, rebel does not always capture the element in some of these movements of acting to defend the rule of law and constitutionalism, end quote. Well, that would be nice if they said, rebel does not always capture the element in the case of a man who lives his life in accordance with the laws of God and the offensive preaching and in the defensive preaching of the laws of God. But see, that wouldn't make it into an article like this, because there are so few people out there today that actually believe in the government of God. The reality of the exclusive government of God, that the concept is so far out of reach because so few people get it. Quote, churches are everywhere. Everywhere you look, there's a quote church. But there's not a man in a million who understands that God has a government and that it's here and now and everyone is supposed to be a citizen of it. Oh yeah, they will claim to defend their quote rule of law and their con, but they don't realize that their quote rule of law and their con are exactly what it means to stick a fist in the face of God and say that no matter what he has told his prophets of old to write, no matter what his son came to do, no matter how the disciples lived and preached, we will live by our quote rule of law and by our con. It continues. In contrast, an attempt for an overthrow of a government by an installation of a limited group of people is a putsch, or by an elite, a coup d'etat. If the existing system of society, like a government or its form, is changed, it is most often called a revolution, end quote. A change in any existing system of society for good must come about when one man here and one man there, one woman here, one woman there, one child here, one child there, has the gospel of the kingdom, government of God, preached to them, and they realize that the government is real, and they must leave the mindset of the nation states of the world and bow in repentance to whatever extent they have been in agreement with the world and embrace the only government that God has allowed to exist, and that is the government of God named in our Bibles as the Commonwealth of Israel. So, while I love to see people running around without state ID quote tags, I so wish that we could reach them with the truth of the present day reality of the government of God. And I've got great hope that they would embrace the government of God and the freedom that comes from knowing the true source of freedom. Now, to the second thing that I saw this past week. There's this guy on YouTube that calls himself James Freeman. And I saw one of his videos, and I thought it was possibly one of the greatest things I've ever seen on YouTube. The link is in the notes. And the title is This an Organized Crime Syndicate? I've got the link is in the notes, and I'm going to put it on the website as well. But this guy goes into a city, quote, government building and asks if the city, quote, government is an organized crime syndicate. And all he's doing is just asking questions about how the city works. I mean, do people fund the city voluntarily, or does it get funded through threats of violence, threats of taking property, etc.? If they don't pay the city, just like an organized crime syndicate would be. And it's amazing how composed the guy is. I mean, how he manages to keep a straight face. He's really a good actor. And he's as calm as can be. Just acts like he's a reporter doing a story and just asking for questions. And the city clerk calls for an armed cop to come and stand in the room where all the guy is doing is calmly asking some questions. And of course, we all know it. It's simple. He called the armed cop into the room as a threat of violence, a show of force, which is exactly how organized crime syndicate operates. Video's excellent. The guy doesn't make any references to the con or to freedom coming from men. He's just making some great points that man's little g quote government is organized crime. I was speaking to James Wayne about this, and yeah, we know people do all sorts of things on YouTube because they're making money off of it, and I get that. And the video's not coming from the viewpoint of a Christian, a true Christ-following Christian. But the principles seen in the video are far closer to those found in the scriptures than from those taught in the, quote, churches. There's no question about that. So when you've got a minute of free time and you want to watch something that I've found to be pretty neat, watch that video. And if the guy gets a few pennies from YouTube or a few credits from YouTube, well, so be it. And if the guy is for real, I sure wish someone could reach him with the good news, with the gospel, that there is a government available to all of us, and that it is not only not an organized crime syndicate, but it's a government that wants its citizens to be free, to be prosperous, to thrive, and to live in peace and joy. You know, Teresa and I have learned through the years that it's usually not been a great idea for us to refer people to movies or videos, because at times you refer something to someone and they just don't get it at all, or they end up hating it. So we've kind of stopped doing the referral thing. But I just felt like this video was good, and that I wanted to pass it along to you. And I actually watched it twice to make sure that there wasn't anything objectionable in it. Now, the one cop at the end talks about his constitution, but this James Freeman doesn't reference the con in what he's trying to accomplish. All right, back to 2 Peter chapter 3's, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. That is the way that God told Peter to write concerning the things that Jesus told him in Matthew 24, 1 through 3. All the times we read about things regarding the end of the world, the coming day of God, the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, the elements melting with fervent heat. This is what Christ was talking about when he told his disciples, "See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world?" Once again, please turn to Matthew chapter 24. Why is it difficult for people to understand that what the apostles wrote, what the apostles preached, came from the teachings of Christ? When we read in 2 Peter chapter 3 phrases such as "looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God," why do we not immediately think of Matthew 24:3? When the disciples, Peter, the same one that wrote 2 Peter 3, why do we not immediately think of Matthew 24:3? "Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming?" When we read in 2 Peter chapter 3 phrases such as "wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat," why do we not immediately think of Matthew 24:3? "Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world?" Does the heavens being on fire and the elements melting with fervent heat, does that not sound like, quote, the end of the world? Well, it certainly does to me. How have we ever been duped into believing that Peter, James, and John, in their last epistles, why do we think that they were talking about things that were different than what Jesus talked about in some of the very last things that Jesus ever told them? Isn't that odd? Isn't it odd to think that Peter would write about things that clearly would make someone think about the, quote, end of the world, the heavens on fire, dissolved, the elements melting with fervent heat? How is that different than Jesus answering his disciples' questions, "Tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world?" I'll tell you why. It's because, quote, churchianity, with its futurist lies, has turned the one who was the real Messiah, the real Son of God, the real King, it has turned him into something that is only for the future. They're looking for a future King, a future Messiah. The Jesus Christ that came in the flesh in the first century is not the one that matters. It's the one that's coming in the future. And that is their Jewish Messiah. Futurism denies that Jesus Christ already came in the flesh. Futurism is the religion of Antichrist. I've been trying to tell people this for 40 years, and sadly, very few people have understood this, but it is the truth. This is why the world is in the shape it's in. 99.999999% of people living believe in a coming Messiah. They do not embrace the one who came in the first century because they believe the lie that that Jesus did not fulfill the prophets, so they look for another. "Well, that's not what I believe," says the church man. "Well, the law book that you live by and have agreed to live according to, and the citizenship that you claim, says otherwise." Matthew chapter 24, beginning with verse 1. "And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world?" The buildings of the temple. Yeah, I've been saying, not just recently, but for my entire ministry, that true Christians do not place one shred of value on anything coming from the Jews, and especially things that pertain to Bible knowledge. They're liars. They've always been liars, and their father is the spirit of the devil from Antichrist. I did an internet search using the phrase, what was the temple in Jerusalem like in the first century? And of course, pretty much the only thing that came back was from the Jews. Well, I thought about reading the whole thing, but there was actually some things in there that I would use against them. And against those who think the Jews are something special, well, they are something special, all right, but not in a godly sense. And hear me well on this. I'm talking about people who do not believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God, who became flesh and walked on this earth in the first century. It doesn't matter whether they take the label Jew or church or whatever. I'm talking about people who do not believe that Jesus Christ came in the flesh in the first century. Churchians promote the Jewish religion, and as such, they are equally antichrist, and it doesn't matter how many times they say the sound J-E-S-U-S or say the sound Y-E-S-H-U-A. If you promote a belief system that denies Jesus Christ, you are just as bad. That shouldn't be difficult. Well, anyway, I'm not going to read their whole article, but I'm going to cite a couple things, and then I'm going to use the biggest citation to expose them. I'm going to use it against them. In regards to the temple in the first century, here are a couple of their claims. Now, this is taken from a Jewish website called MyJewishLearning.com, and the article is titled 12 Things to Know About the Temple in Jerusalem. On Tisha B'Av, Jews mourn the destruction of the temple. But how much do you know about what it was really like? Long ago, as prescribed by the Hebrew scriptures, Jewish worship revolved around the temple in Jerusalem. For 1,000 years, the temple was a hub for offering sacrifices of all sorts, peace offerings, thanksgiving offerings, atonement offerings, and more, every day of the year. On the 3 annual pilgrimage festivals, Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot, all Israel was invited to ascend to Jerusalem to offer special sacrifices and celebrate. The temple also served as an important administrative center of the Jewish people. All this came to a screeching halt in 70 CE, when the temple was destroyed in a devastating war with the Romans. In its wake, Rabbinic Judaism, the Judaism practiced by virtually all Jews today, and its central text, the Talmud, laid the foundation for Jewish ritual and worship in a world without the temple, end quote. Of course it came to a screeching halt. Jesus Christ said it would. Approximately 40 years before it came to a screeching halt, Jesus Christ told his disciples that it would be destroyed to the point where not one stone would be standing upon another that would not be thrown down. They admit that the temple was completely destroyed in AD 70. Now, of course, the blasphemers say 70 CE, not AD 70. But the temple was destroyed. The Jews know it. Most churchians don't even know about it because they've not placed their trust in the words of Jesus Christ. Their faith is not in Christ, but instead on some future coming Messiah, just like the Jews who denied Jesus Christ. The article continues, even though remembering the temple remains a central part of Jewish practice today, it can be difficult to grasp just how central the temple was to ancient Jewish life. Here are 12 facts that help illustrate what the ancient temple was really like and what it has meant to Jews throughout history, end quote. Well, yes, it's difficult to grasp because the Jews reject Christ, so they don't see the significance of Jesus telling his disciples that the temple was going to be destroyed exactly when he said it would be destroyed. And then those who have played, quote, church and continue to play, quote, church, have believed the lies of C.I. Schofield, who say that in Matthew 24, Jesus wasn't even talking about the temple in Jerusalem that day. Even though the text says as clearly as anything ever was in our Bibles, Jesus said to his disciples, "See this temple." And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, "See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." That is just incredible to me. He said it. Schofield said it. I showed you where he said it. And people have believed it. Amazing. Take these simple words of Christ and tell people that's really not what it means. And they believe it. In Matthew 24, Jesus was telling his disciples concerning that very temple that was in existence that very day, that that temple was going to be destroyed, not one stone left standing upon another, and Schofield managed to convince people that Jesus was really talking about some other temple that would be rebuilt some 2,000 years later. And now today in 2025, you've got these, quote, churchians telling people that a rebuilt temple in Jerusalem is of God, that it fulfills Bible prophecy. Well, I guess when you can convince people that a piece of paper in your pocket is more valuable or just as valuable as a solid gold coin, I guess you could convince them of anything. And I often think about those days. My grandfather was a really smart man. Did you know that he was the lead man for Bell Telephone in providing telephone service to almost the entire East Coast back in the 1920s. He was pretty smart, but he was there during that time when people were duped into thinking that a piece of paper that said $20 on it was as valuable as a gold coin that said $20 on it. Well, today you can buy a $20 gold coin for about 3,000 U.S. quote dollars. And take out a $20 paper bill, and I realize that's hard because nearly impossible for most U.S. citizens to do because their piece of plastic is of more valuable to them than even their paper is, but see what that $20 will buy in comparison to the $20 gold 1 ounce coin and what it will buy. 3,000 versus 20. I just can't fathom how people who were used to carrying around gold and silver coins in their pockets thought that it was a better idea to switch to a piece of paper, but they did. So I guess it's not that big of a deal to think that a slick-dressed, slick-tongued, quote, preacher could convince people that Jesus wasn't really talking about that temple that day when he told his disciples, "See this temple." Okay, the Jewish article continues. Number one, There were actually two temples on the same spot. The first temple, built by King Solomon in approximately 1000 BCE, was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BCE. And the reason I made such a big deal out of CE and AD a little bit ago is because BC to us means before Christ. BCE to the Jew means before the common era. CE means common era. AD means Anno Domini, in the year of our Lord. And of course, they can't do that. When the Persians conquered the Babylonians almost a century later, they agreed to let the Jewish leaders who had been taken into exile return to the land of Israel, where they would rebuild the temple. This second temple stood for hundreds more years, then was thoroughly renovated and expanded by Herod the Great in the last few decades before the beginning of the Common Era. The second temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE. Number two, the temple was built on a mountain that goes by many names. Jerusalem is in the hill country. The temple was situated on one particular rise that goes by many names in the Hebrew scriptures. The Torah never identifies the mountain, but simply talks about the place God will choose to rest his name. The specific mountain is identified in Isaiah and the book of Psalms as Mount Zion. The biblical book of Chronicles, however, calls it Mount Moriah. Micah 4:1 refers to it generically as Har Bayit Adonai, meaning the mount of the house of the Lord. Jeremiah shortens this to Har Bayit, the mountain of the house, commonly translated as the Temple Mount. This last name, Temple Mount, is used frequently in the Mishnah and Talmud and other rabbinic literature, which is why the, quote, churchians refer to it as such. Listen to this one. Number three, the temple stood on the spot where the world began. According to the Talmud, on the top of Mount Moriah is a foundation stone from which God created the whole world. This same foundation stone later lay under the Holy of Holies, the most sacred room of the temple. Ancient interpreters also believe that more than a millennium before the temple was built, the stone was the site of the binding of Isaac. End quote. Okay, so then it is fitting to say that that was the spot that the world ended. When we understand what Jesus meant by the end of the world, it makes perfect sense. The end of the world means the end of the old covenant age. It means the end of the age. The Greek word is aeon, and it means age. The destruction of the temple, the destruction of Jerusalem, that they were physical things that were destroyed indeed, but the phrase is symbolic with the end of the old covenant age, which, as we saw from Hebrews chapter 12, the old covenant revolved around many physical things, the temple being the most central thing of it. And it was destroyed, symbolizing the end of the old covenant. The physical destruction of those things were meant for physical judgment also. The end of the old covenant age was physical and spiritual. It was literal and symbolic. And it was the end of that world. Listen to this one. The temple was enormous. Picturing something the size of a synagogue? Not even close. In the first century, when Herod renovated the temple, he began by building a retaining wall around the Temple Mount and then constructing a platform over the top, turning the mount into a four-sided plateau 37 acres in area. The temple complex itself contained a series of courtyards surrounding the central room, the Holy of Holies, which was only entered once a year on Yom Kippur by the high priest. In addition to the large courtyards and Holy of Holies, the temple complex contained many other storage and administrative rooms. Listen to this now. Plus, numerous ritual baths for purification. End quote. Ritual baths for purification. The false teachings of, quote, church renamed this to something called, quote, baptism. And then they tried to deceive people into keeping the old covenant rituals, the baths for purification. They have deceived people into believing that the physical aspect of water purification that was commanded in the old covenant that it is still for today in the new covenant world. Friends, the physical requirements of the old covenant, whether it was physical blood, a physical temple, or physical water, those elements melted away with fervent heat when the old covenant ended and the new covenant, new heavens, and new earth began. We are not to revive the physical elements of the old covenant. We are not to bring those old covenant elements back to life. The old covenant water purification rituals were only there to point people to the coming water of life called Jesus Christ, who, if you drink from the water that he gives, you will never thirst again. Can we pause here for just a minute? I've said many times over and over, actually, that the physical water washings of the old covenant pointed to Christ, the living water. And it got back to me that someone had said how ridiculous that was because you don't drink, quote, baptism. To which I respond, really? Well, I think we need to know what the whole Bible says about water and not just a few cherry-picked out-of-context verses. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and read the first four verses. Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all of our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and were all immersed unto Moses, overwhelmed by the power of God unto Moses, symbolically placed into God, a symbolic ceremony of asking forgiveness and having nothing to do with physical water, in the cloud and in the sea. This symbolic, non-physical washing was a ceremony of which they did all eat the same spiritual meat and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Yes, absolutely, drinking the living water of Jesus Christ is a symbolic washing with spiritual water of drinking of that spiritual rock, and that rock was Christ. The temple had physical water washing facilities inside of it in obedience to the law God gave Moses. And when that temple was destroyed, so was the physical water ritual of the old covenant law that God gave Moses. And when did that happen? A.D. 70. While the temple was still standing, the old covenant laws that applied to the temple were still in place. This is why we see the disciples in the book of Acts going to the temple every single day, being present for the daily sacrifices, the daily blood animal lamb sacrifices, in obedience to the law found in Exodus 29:38-42 and Numbers 28:3-8. This is why we see the disciples obeying the water purification laws concerning entrance into the temple. But this is why we see the disciples telling believers that they were to obey the laws God gave Moses, but not in the name of, in the authority of Moses, but in the name of, in the authority of Jesus Christ. One of the biggest of all the confusing things in, quote, church is the fact that Paul went into the temple to offer a sacrifice. They're confused about Paul, but they fail to understand that all of them sacrificed. They all went to the temple daily to participate in the daily sacrifice that God had commanded Moses in the law God gave Moses. The only thing that was a big deal about Paul sacrificing was that in his ministry, he was telling Christians not living around Jerusalem, around the temple, that even before the temple was destroyed, they were not bound to the temple laws that God gave Moses. So there are so many silly explanations from the, quote, churchmen, when the simplest, easiest thing to understand is that while the temple was still standing, the old covenant laws concerning sacrifice were still in place for those who were near the temple. The old covenant world did not end officially until the temple came down. Not one stone standing upon another. That was the end of the old covenant world, just like Jesus said. And if you don't believe that in Matthew 24, Jesus was talking about that temple of that day, then yeah, you're going to come up with all sorts of crazy, ridiculous things. The reason most people who have received their Bible instruction from quote church that they do not understand this is because they arrived at 2 Peter 3 in some quote church setting or some quote church Bible study, and someone jerked 2 Peter chapter 3 out of the Bible and laid it on a table and made some religion out of it without understanding that Jesus talked about the end of the world first. Jesus talked about it long before Peter did. Jesus is the one who told Peter about the end of the world. Peter's teaching doesn't supersede Christ's. When Peter was describing the end of the world, he was talking about the exact same thing that Jesus was. It was the end of the old covenant world and the beginning of the new covenant world, the new heavens and the new earth. Back to the Jews, quote, "The whole system was fed by an aqueduct that brought water from 10 kilometers away, and it was protected by high walls and a series of gates. To get a sense of the scale, consider that the Kotel, the famous western wall that is a Jewish holy site, is what remains of just a piece of the western side of the retaining wall around the Temple Mount." Then lastly, number 12. Jews don't agree about whether a third temple should be built. End quote. Well, yeah, Jews don't agree, but the quote churchian Jews agree. It's the churchian Jews that teach a rebuilt temple in Jerusalem. And they got this lie from Schofield again, and it's a complete denial that Jesus was the Christ. The third temple is not a physical temple. It's the kingdom of God within you. It's a spiritual temple. It's called the Spirit of God dwelling within those who embrace His government. It's not physical. Turn to John chapter 4. Read beginning in verse 20. This is the woman of Samaria speaking to Christ. "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship? Jesus saith unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Ye worship ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshipper shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship Him. God is a spirit, and they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. The woman saith unto Him, I know that Messiah cometh, which is called Christ. When He is come, He will tell us all things. Jesus saith unto her, I that speak unto thee am He." Turn to John chapter 2. Read beginning with verse 18. "Then answered the Jews and said unto Him, What sign showest thou unto us, seeing that thou doest these things? Jesus answered and said unto them, Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Then said the Jews, 46 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou rear it up in 3 days? But He spake of the temple of His body. When therefore He was risen from the dead, His disciples remembered that He had said this unto them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said." Jesus is the rebuilt temple. There is no physically rebuilt temple, and those who teach such are deniers that Jesus was the Christ, and they teach heresy. Acts 7:48. "Howbeit the Most High dwelleth not in temples made with hands, as saith the prophet, Heaven is my throne, and earth is my footstool. What house will you build me, saith the Lord, or what is the place of my rest?" Acts 17:24, "God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that He is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands as though He needeth anything, seeing He giveth to all life and breath and all things." The days of the physical temple were coming, the end of the days of the physical temple were coming very soon to an end in the first century. Just like Jesus said, The temple was destroyed. The physical temple was destroyed, just like all the rest of the physical elements of the old covenant, and they are not to be rebuilt again. This Jewish Churchian article continues. For thousands of years, Jews have mourned the destruction of the temple on Tisha B'Av and prayed for its reconstruction, but it has never happened, even now that a Jewish state exists in the land of Israel. There are many reasons for this. First, the Temple Mount is under Muslim authority and home to a sacred Islamic shrine, the Dome of the Rock. A temple could not be built on that spot without destroying it. You see the conflict between the Jews and the Arabs. Second, not all Jews believe God has granted them authority to rebuild the temple. Many hold that only God will build it. Third, Judaism has flourished for thousands of years without a temple, since the rabbis say that Torah study and prayer can replace temple service. There is less urgency to bring back a temple, and many Jews agree with that sacrifices are no longer the best way to worship God. End quote. Oh, baloney. They don't sacrifice anymore because they think that might be what could push the world against them. How dare they kill a sweet little lamb for their religion? The politically correct world of 2025 might not tolerate their religious killings of animals. That's why they don't sacrifice animals. Early leaders in the Reform movement even named their houses of worship temples to signify they had abandoned the traditional Jewish longing to rebuild the temple. There are, however, a minority of Jews who are preparing to build a third temple by studying temple worship practices and constructing implements to be used in the temple when it's rebuilt, end quote. Yeah, a minority of, quote, Jews and an overwhelming majority of, quote, Churchians. Rebuilding the temple, what blasphemy! The reinstituting of animal sacrifices, what blasphemy! It's the, quote, church that is pushing for these things. I just read that there's only a minority of Jews that are preparing for a rebuilt temple, and only a minority of Jews want animal sacrifices again. But there's a majority of Churchians who demand both. Absolutely unbelievable. 2 Peter chapter 3's ending of the world is the exact same end of the world that Jesus told them about in Matthew 24. That's where they got their information from to begin with. All right, go back to Matthew 24 and verse 4. And Jesus said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you. Deceive them regarding what? The coming of the Lord and the end of the world. The end of the old covenant age. Exactly the same language that Peter is using in 2 Peter chapter 3. Now verse 5. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. As I try to remind people every time we look at this chapter, this is Jesus to his disciples in the first century. Jesus is telling them about his coming. The great day of the Lord is what Peter called it, and the end of the world. Peter called it the dissolution of the heavens, the elements melting with fervent heat. In 2 Peter chapter 3 and Matthew chapter 24, it's talking about the same thing. In the end, shortly before my coming, shortly before the great day of the Lord, shortly before the end of the world, the end of the age. For nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall rise, and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. Endure unto the end of what? What shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? All these words of Christ are answers to the disciples' original questions. what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Then shall the end come? What end? What shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? All of this is Jesus answering their question. It's all talking about the end of the old covenant world that is symbolized physically and spiritually by the destruction of the temple, something that even the ungodly Jews admit happened in the first century. You know, lie as they may, lie as much as they do, Jews and Churchians, there are some things that just can't be denied. There was a temple in Jerusalem during the time of Christ. Jesus said that the generation that he was speaking to would not pass away until that temple was completely destroyed. And in 2025, even the Christ-hating Jews admit that the temple in existence in the first century was completely destroyed. Again now, it's Jesus to his disciples in the first century, verse 15, when you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. The abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet was an event that also ended the daily sacrifices. The daily sacrifices were going on in the temple almost until the time of the temple's destruction in 70 AD. 40 years from the time Jesus said, "This generation shall not pass away till all these things be fulfilled." Verse 16, "Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be." He's talking about the end of the world. "And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Then if any man shall say unto you, Lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that, if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Behold, I have told you before. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, Behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. Behold, he is in the secret chambers, believe it not. For as the lightning cometh out of the east, and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken." In 2 Peter chapter 3, it's talking about the exact same thing that Jesus is talking about here in Matthew 24. It's the same thing. "And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from the one end of heaven to the other." It's talking about the same thing as 2 Peter chapter 3, the great coming day of the Lord. "Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and putteth forth leaves, ye know that summer is nigh. So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." Now watch. "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away." And indeed it did. That's because the heaven and earth that Jesus was talking about, the one that Peter was talking about, is symbolic language for the old covenant world, the old covenant age. The failure to understand this has resulted in a colossal failure to understand what our entire purpose is for. It's to lose the meaning of what we're supposed to be doing. Most people are waiting. They're looking to the sky in hopes of a better future. They're looking for some future golden age. Well, and then when someone like Trump promises them a golden age in the here and now, they jump on it. And they're deceived as my grandfather was, who thought it was a good idea to trade pieces of paper and give the, quote, government their gold and silver. The kingdom, government of God is here, it's now. And it's the responsibility of every living, breathing creature to renounce the little g, quote, governments of men and enter into the only God-ordained government allowed to exist, and that is the government of God, the kingdom of God, so named the Commonwealth of Israel in our Bibles in Ephesians chapter 2. Well, we've still got so much more to talk about concerning 2 Peter chapter 3, and the plan is to pick back up next week at this same place.
You've been listening to God Send Us Men Ministries with evangelist and missionary to America, Charlie Stewart. To contact us or to read and listen to more teachings online for free, visit GodSendUsMen.com.